Hello, and welcome back to Unlocking Markets, the RBC BlueRay podcast, where we bring you experts from across our firm providing opinions on markets, global policy, and macroeconomics, whilst highlighting how these feed into our investment decisions. I'm Mike Reed, Head of Global Financial Institutions. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Habib Subjani, Head of our Global Equities team. Habib last appeared on the show in June 2024, and an awful lot has happened in the subsequent 9 months. After a strong finish to 2024 itself, the inauguration of President Trump appears to introduce uncertainty to global markets. So I'm hoping Habib can give us some fresh insights into what is driving this volatility and how he is navigating his portfolios through it. So Habib, welcome back to the podcast.
Mike, thank you for having me on. We live in interesting times.
We do indeed. So to kick off, Habib, I mean, since President Trump arrived back at the White House, he has implemented widespread tariffs on the goods from a broad range of countries, both friends and foes. How is this uncertainty stemming from the trade wars influencing investor sentiment as you see it?
Well, I mean, tariffs have been, we haven't really had serious tariffs at this level for decades. So this is uncharted territory for many, certainly for developed markets. And tariffs and other policy announcements create uncertainty. This level of uncertainty leads both consumers and businesses to delay consumption and investment decisions. I mean, this is only natural. We see this in consumer sentiment data. We see this in conversations we have with business leaders, that everyone is slowing down their big investment decisions, whether that's creating building a new factory or some new technology project. I mean, all of those things are just being slowed down. So certainly for now, sentiment is much more cautious. But in terms of how we think about tariffs, right? So we've obviously been through the portfolio with a fine-tooth comb. So tariffs have many consequences, but the big three that I would point out are tariffs impact goods and not services. So if you are Ford or General Motors, you are really worried about what's going on with tariffs in your supply chain. But if you're Netflix, you're sort of sitting there saying, well, yes, I'm sure it has some impact, but nothing directly to our business. The second big impact that tariffs have is that it impacts consumers, just in terms of their disposable income, what money buys. And the third thing that it leads to is cost increases and potentially inflation. So in terms of how we think about those things, we examined our portfolio very carefully for businesses with complex supply chains. So obviously industrial companies that have, if you have a factory in Mexico, you're kind of stuck with this. There's nothing you can do about that. And, thankfully, we don't have anything like that. But we do have some businesses that do that buy components from many different parts of the world, some of which will be Mexico, Canada, and China. And this time around, it means there will be a cost increase, but you won't get like in the pandemic when you had that shortage of semiconductors. You production lines came to a halt. This won't lead to that, but you will have some cost increases coming through. And supply chains will also impact businesses like retailers and distributors, but they are in a better position to price up and pass on those increases. So supply chains is the first thing. It's go through businesses and look at their supply chains and see who's resilient. Second is be careful about the low-end consumer. They are going to get impacted around the world, and particularly also the emerging market consumer. And thirdly, it's about pricing power. A lot of people, a lot of businesses are going to be impacted by rising costs. Can they pass that on? And so that pricing power becomes crucial in maintaining your margins and your cash flows.
I can see there's a lot of uncertainty there feeding into businesses and creating caution there. But on a personal level, I'm glad to hear that my Netflix subscription is not going to go up any further. Going back to when we chatted last year, I asked you about the outperformance of US stocks and versus the rest of the world, and in particular by the group of tech stocks that have been dubbed the Magnificent Seven. Since the start of 2025, we have seen a reversal of this trend. I mean, are we seeing an end to US exceptionalism? And is this going to be reflected in your investment decisions?
Yeah, well, it certainly is the case in the short run that when you look at what's happened, this uncertainty that we spoke about a few seconds ago has led to a reversal of many of these of the trends that were well-established trends in the market for many years. The U.S. equity market is down 5% year to date. Europe is up almost 16%. Hong Kong is up almost 18%. And this is following many years of US being essentially the only market that outperformed the collective world. Everything else underperformed. Also, things like technology, IT is down 9%, the Magnificent Seven are down 14%, and something like Tesla is down 42%. So these are violent moves that have taken place, and this is over a period. What it's early March when we're speaking. You know, this is we're talking about 9 weeks of 9 to 10 weeks the year. So this has been a very powerful move. The real question is how long will this continue? And it's hard to say if this level of policy uncertainty begins to settle down, if. We sort of, this is the worst, this is sort of, we are over this is the bottom. We then get some tax cuts and the budget deficit, and then you also get cost cutting from the government coming through, so the budget deficit doesn't get out of control. That can, and a bit of stability can lead to a recovery, but so much depends on that backdrop. You know, in terms of how we, you know, you asked me the question, I'm not ducking it, Mike, about how we are dealing with this. So over the last couple of years, last year or so, we had been getting a bit nervous about how extreme things were becoming. And let's be clear, these Magnificent Seven or the mega caps, these top 10 companies that we look at, these weren't there by fluke. These are great businesses. They are phenomenal business. They have innovated, they have executed, they've delivered phenomenal service and generated revenues and earnings and cash flows to justify their position there. But after so many years of success, these mega caps are also the most expensive part of the market. So we had been sort of steadily reducing our exposure there. And so we were underweight the mega caps. We were neutral weight the rest of the US, and we were marginally overweight the rest of the world. And again, especially in the mega caps, your valuation disciplines have to be really careful there. And ultimately, that's what's going to protect you, because you have to be aware that no business, while these are great businesses, no business stays great forever. You know, trees do not grow to the sky. And that's why I think a degree of skepticism and caution was necessary. And maybe we went there a bit too early, but I think we've been gradually been inching towards the door over probably last 10, 12 months.
Touching on something you just said there was cost cutting and within the US budget. And one of the ways that they've talked about doing this around the world is the use of artificial intelligence to help them there and make things more efficient. I mean, it was a major theme. Artificial intelligence was a major theme for investors last year and drove a lot of investing and was responsible in part for the performance of a number of stocks, particularly NVIDIA, which is very much highlighted. But then early this year, we've had the arrival of DeepSeek, which was a bit of a shock to the market. It's the cheaper Chinese version of ChatGPT. And this has raised questions that I've spoken to a number of investors I've spoken to in their minds as to the invulnerability, or sometimes we talk about the moat, of certain companies to competition. I mean, do you see potential risks from new entrants in other areas of the market?
Yeah, so do you mean about artificial intelligence, about new
Yeah.
entrants?
There are a number of companies that have done very well, and they're rated on the back of that. with artificial intelligence coming in, is there, are there other areas, other companies or areas that you think might be exposed to a new entrant coming in, something we haven't seen as yet?
Yeah, look, I think, artificial intelligence is really interesting, right? Because it is a phenomenal enabling technology. It is a little bit like when spreadsheets first came around, or when mobile phones first came around. So spreadsheets, if you remember, were created. I mean, you and I will probably remember those, Mike. But it was IBM with Lotus 1-2-3 and a Computer Associates with SuperCalc.
I'm still using Lotus 1-2-3.
I'm surprised. I thought it didn't exist anymore. But the key thing is that IBM and Computer Associates didn't make much money out of it, even though they were the pioneers. The real people that made money out of it was Microsoft with Excel. And more importantly, people like us and all of your listeners, everyone who used Excel and spreadsheets to improve their business and improve business decisions and productivity. The same way with mobile phones, Nokia, Ericsson, all the the Vodafones and of this world created that. Without those pioneers, none of this would be possible. But where are they now? And arguably, most of the benefit from mobile phones have come to other businesses who have created apps and users and consumers who have otherwise benefit from productivity. So I think we think of AI in the same way, that of course there are the pioneers like the NVIDIAs of this world are phenomenal and without which we wouldn't be talking about AI. But as we look forward, who is going to use AI? Who's going to utilize AI to create competitive advantage in their own business, to take market share, to reduce their costs, to improve customer satisfaction? And here we are sort of been shifting our emphasis away from this hardware layer of TSMC and NVIDIA towards more software companies who are going to improve the productivity of users, both corporate users, so that our employers are prepared to pay another $20, $30, $40 a month so that we can have AI tools on our desktops, as well as us as consumers, that we are either prepared to pay $10, $20 a month subscriptions to some of these things, or we are prepared to tolerate more advertising to use these things because it makes our lives better. So artificial intelligence is, we think, is going to enter a new phase. It's not just about, wow, aren't these large language models amazing? And they are, but how are we going to use it and how are we going to create amazing commercial outcomes out of this? And that's where the emphasis has to change. And I do think when you look at the engineering profession, the architecture profession, the financial services industry, the medical industry, the drug discovery industry, all of these industries will be able to utilize artificial intelligence in different ways, shapes, and forms. And there will be winners and losers. Those people who lag behind, don't have the right adoption, will go out of business. Others will gain market share, create new business models, and there will be an enormous amount of wealth destruction and wealth creation from this.
Oh, no, I would like to add just in the comments for in case my IT head is listening today, I don't actually use Lotus 1-2-3. I am fully conversant in Excel.
Yes.
I want to move the podcast aside, a darker place now. And one word that I have heard quite frequently recently is recession. And this time, I mean, last year people were talking about Europe flirting with recession, but now it's not Europe, it's the US. And how does one, or how do you, should I say, position your portfolios to mitigate the risks associated with an economic downturn and protect your investments from potential market corrections?
Look, this is a difficult one, especially in these circumstances. I mean, normally recessions are induced by monetary policy, by central banks, by raising interest rates. or other external events. So you can kind of analyze those, and you know when you and everyone then starts thinking about when the central banks are going to start cutting rates to induce a recovery. So that is something that markets can analyze in a much more predictable and understood by markets. This is unusual in the sense that this policy uncertainty has come from, let's say, from a policy perspective, from a government perspective, from a fiscal perspective. And it's that uncertainty that has created this economic slowdown. Now, whether it results in a recession or not, but it seems pretty clear that the economy in the US is slowing. So, and we don't know what the mechanisms will be to reverse that trend. But you do know a recession is not going to last forever. It's the timing that is hard. But as ever, you know, the principles are to have businesses that have strong balance sheets, that have resilient business models, that have great management teams that are nimble and pragmatic. And more importantly, businesses that take advantage of recessions and slowdowns to take market share, to build customer loyalty, to actually build those relationships and to do the R&D that when the economy actually recovers, they're in a better position to capture a disproportionate amount of market share and value when you come out of the recession.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a challenge going into a recession. And this one's, as you say, if it happens, obviously we're not there yet, it's caused by different influences. So it's less predictable than in the past. And on that, touching on Europe, you know, I said in recent weeks there's been a seismic shift in the European outlook with the newly elected German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, proposing to abandon the German debt brake, as it's known, and massively increase state borrowing and spending. This feels like a once-in-a-generation change, and I would love to hear your thoughts on how you and your team are looking to invest in this new paradigm.
Again, this is a really interesting topic, and we've spent quite a lot of time discussing this. If these seismic shifts come from announcements, like you remember back in the global financial crisis, that whatever it takes kind of moment. Right, and central banks can do that because they have a very clear implementation strategy. But when politicians make these big statements, great, I get the intent, I really do, and I can see the numbers, and the numbers are huge, and then there's a multiplier effect. But how do they get this done? There are so many political and socio-political and socio-economic impediments ahead of them. So you first have to get these laws passed. You then have to get, let's call it, shovels in the ground. How long does it take, for the planning permission, for the various different agreements to be made before it actually starts having an impact on the broader economy? When do the production lines start actually get up and running? When do people get employed? When do loans start getting taken out? And that can take a lot longer than it takes. Will Europe change their attitude towards regulation and planning? And will they drive productivity? And how will this flow through in a pan-European basis? Will the different countries be able to collaborate with each other and, win a little, lose a little? That we remain to be seen. Markets have moved incredibly fast, and this narrative that is being created is that this is the renaissance of Europe, and we're going to have this enormous productivity boom. Driven by the fact that Europe is now incredibly focused on defense. I get the narrative, but how long does that narrative take to come into action and actually deliver economic growth so that companies and consumers can feel that in their wage packet and their revenues and orders. And I think that we remain slightly skeptical about that.
Yeah, I think when I was in the market, you used to call that the flash to bang time, and so
Yes.
there might be a period between the two. But I mean, we've spoken about US and now Europe. So you know, let's complete the globe, or the main parts of the globe that you can invest in, and move to Asia, where we've seen increasing tensions between US and China, and that's creating geopolitical problems, particularly with respect to the security of Taiwan. And in addition, we have witnessed rising inflation in Japan, which is something you know we haven't really seen in a long time. It's a broad question, but where do you see the opportunities in the region currently, and how concerned are you about these well-publicized risks?
Look, the risks are there, right? And you can't avoid them. And of course, you had to be concerned with them. But these risks have been there for a while and will continue to be there. But I think what seems to be happening in Asia is that new trade corridors are opening up, new interdependencies are starting to get created. We see trade among ASEAN with China, with India. Even China and India are now trading more with each other. You also see, we talk about this defense insecurity that is impacting Europe. You see something very similar in Japan. And no doubt, I'm sure there will be similar conversations taking place in Korea and many other countries. So I think this same sense of urgency that is having an impact in Europe, and we are taking so much paying so much attention to that in Europe. I mean, Japan has also committed to doubling its defense budget. So I think there things can perhaps happen a bit faster, more quickly. China is changing the government there is changing its attitude towards wealth creation and entrepreneurialism. I think there has been a simmering tension there amongst the wealth creators, and you've seen with DeepSeek and things like that. There's no shortage of human capital in China and the ability to innovate and execute. So, and those markets are. Had multi-year sort of depressed results there. So we're certainly looking more closely at those markets.
Yeah, I know it's a lot of moving parts, and I've spent a lot of time today asking you about the big picture and macroeconomic trends, but I know you and your team spend a lot of time, or most of your time, I would say, thinking about the basics and the bottom up, and that's how you drive a lot of your investment decisions. And corporate earnings and stock valuations form the bedrock of investing in equities. And with the current economic and political backdrop, which sectors do you feel, if you can help us, will perform best over the coming months?
This is kind of it goes back to a kind of a macro call, right, in terms of sectors, because it does become, if the economic slowdown continues, then, the discretionary and technology will clearly be impacted by this. People aren't going to rush out to buy new cars or new homes or, all the stuff that you put into a new home. That will be impacted, and certainly, companies and capital goods companies, if they're not rushing out to build new factories, that will be impacted. So you can see that there is this shift towards more defensive, more stable, more reliable businesses with recurring revenues. But as a long-term bottom-up investor, I think this is also a period where you have great opportunity to find businesses that are going to take advantage of this when everyone else is cutting costs and firing people, that someone else who is prepared to step up and really innovate or look after their customers. There is going to be, when we look back on this will be a period where market share was gained and lost, new winners emerged, and old winners just faded away and never came back. And that for us is a real challenge, is to to meet management teams and to assess individual strategies, and who is prepared to, in a very safe and controlled and a risk-controlled manner, who's prepared to get onto the front foot and actually grow the business and lay the foundations for future growth. I mean, we forget how long it takes to create a new brand, to build a new hotel, to create a new factory, these things take 4, 5, 6 years. The market moves in days and weeks, or if not minutes and seconds, right? But I mean, this for us is kind of the great opportunity.
Yeah, I guess that's the Warren Buffett model of investing, which is buy good businesses at the right prices.
Absolutely. And in many respects, the sales have started, right?
It sounds easy. It does, but it's obviously incredibly challenging, incredibly difficult. Well, thank you, Aviv. As you say, we live in interesting times. It was great to get your perspectives on global equities. You and your team have such deep knowledge across a really broad range of countries and economies. So it was fantastic to hear your insights. The next 12 months promise to be fascinating, and I look forward to having you back on the show again soon.
Anytime. Thanks, Mike.
Many thanks for listening to the show. If you've enjoyed it, please like and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Next time on the show, we will be joined by Mike Schoen, who from our securitized credit team, which is an area of finance that is frequently misunderstood, but one which has been attracting a lot of interest from our clients recently. If you wish to listen to any of the previous editions of the Unlocking Markets podcast, they're available on our website, www.bluebay.com, or can be found on Apple, Spotify, or Google. Thank you once again for joining us today. Good luck and goodbye.
This podcast is issued by RBC BlueBay or one of its entities. Please check the entire RBC BlueBay disclaimer at the following website, www.rbcbluebay.com/podcast disclaimer. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only. It is not intended, nor should it be intended, as investment, tax, or legal advice. This podcast does not constitute an offer to sell, nor is it a solicitation of an offer to purchase any security or investment product in any jurisdiction. This podcast is not available for distribution in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be prohibited, and it is not aimed at such persons in those jurisdictions. Past performance is not indicative of future results. RBC BlueBay makes no express or implied warranties or representations with respect to the information contained in this podcast, and hereby expressly disclaim all warranties of accuracy or completeness or fitness for a particular purpose. RBC BlueBay is under no obligation to update the information in the podcast or to reflect changes after the publication date. The information contained in this podcast is believed to be reliable, but RBC BlueBay cannot and does not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness. The document is intended only for professional clients and eligible counterparties as defined by the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive or in the US by accredited investors as defined in the Securities Act of 1933 or qualified purchasers as defined in the Investment Company Act of 1940 as applicable and should not be relied upon by any other category of consumer. No part of this document may be reproduced, redistributed, or passed on directly or indirectly to any other person or published in whole or in part, for any purpose, in any manner, without the prior written permission of RBC BlueBay or one of its entities.